Basically, what I'm arguing is that we shouldn't be too happy with ourselves. We should be too complacent about the democracy we live in. We shouldn't go around like we have it figured out just yet. That there are still structures in our society that are authoritarian. So you might see glimpses of this in this particular talk. You have to excuse me if I read this. It's supposed to be an argued point that I'm making, but I did try and write this so that it might be at least half engaging. You'll also find some additional information on here. I won't explain who the authors I'm talking about are, but the information is up on there for you, so that this way you can actually follow along a little bit. Just so that I don't have to spend half an hour explaining who Hannah Arendt is, for instance. So when a person runs in an election, we expect that they'll make promises. That's the whole point of a campaign. The promises they make usually have to do with doing the minimum that's expected of government. Maintaining the peace and order, governing well, and sometimes with striving and taking at least minimal steps towards achieving common values, such as life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Election campaigns have a lot to do with the promises that politicians make, promises as to what will be done with public money, promises as to what will be done as far as the results we can expect of the actions of the government over the course of a few years. However, we don't actually expect that the candidates for whom we vote will keep all or even most of their promises. We never vote again, maybe that's why we don't vote. We expect that compromise will be necessary. We expect that events will counter the best laid plans. We expect that previous governments and actions leave a legacy that's not wiped clean by the elections. We expect that even the best intentions are limited by adversity, by the fact that those who govern don't govern alone. What's more, we expect that candidates and parties make some promises they know they will not be able to keep. Public promises that have to do with naked self-interest at times, public promises to those who will help them gain power, but promises that might also have to do with values, with the kind of government and governors that we wish to have, with the kind of comfortable life that we wish to experience, promises that will give them an idea of who they are as individuals. So when candidates make explicit promises as to the actions they're going to undertake, when they make these promises during an election campaign, they also make implicit promises. It's of these implicit promises that I want to talk about today. I'll be discussing three meanings of the action of promising, beginning with the promises that are made and broken in act, both as a program and as a strategy to gain power. I'll argue that the very action of presenting themselves as candidates, the action that leads them to make promises in the first place, is in itself a democratic promise, a promise to act democratically. And finally, the repetition of this democratic promise from one election to the next creates a set of expectations that can be understood as forming the promise of democracy, a promise of a different kind of life in common. So let me begin by asking a question. What is a promise? A promise is not simply words. The words we utter when we make a promise are not just words that need to be backed up or guaranteed. A promise is not a contract, it's not an agreement. No one enforces a promise. Promises remain outside of the law. That's probably a good thing for most people. A promise does not require that any specific consequences result if it is broken. If a promise is broken, it's up to a person to whom the promise was made in the first place to decide if they will let another promise be made again, to decide if trust is still possible. So the words in the promise stand by themselves. They are an action. What do we do when we make a promise? We engage ourselves towards someone else. We create a relationship with them by allowing them to know what they can expect of us. We put ourselves at the mercy, so to speak. We let their judgment define us. We bind ourselves to them, but only because we are already bound to them in the first place. Only because we are already close enough to them that they know they can trust us. So that the promise can have a meaning. It can be a promise rather than mere words. We let them know that what is the case at this moment will remain the case later. We let them know that they can count on us now, that they'll be able to count on us in the future. We tell them that we will act in a specific manner, that we will undertake specific actions, that we will maintain a specific kind of behavior. So the only way to keep a promise is to continue acting in that specified manner. In making a promise, we precipitate ourselves towards this action, we inaugurate it, we begin it, we undertake the action we promise to accomplish. We enter a course of action, a change of behavior, even a change of our whole character by announcing it. And at times, the context in which we act, the context in which we place ourselves in a role, such as the role of a parent, of a friend, or of a democratic ruler, but that context, that role carries an implicit promise. To take on the role, rather than to have it be imposed on us, is to make a promise. So in promising, we go beyond choosing and deciding. We make the choice effective. And as I'll argue in a moment, we bind ourselves at once towards ourselves and towards others. In the human condition, Hannah Arendt suggested that we make promises to make up for the fragility of human affairs. That is, to make up for the fact that we never know whether our actions will succeed or fail. To make up for the fact that we can never fully predict the consequences of our actions will have. As each person changes throughout their life, following their actions, following those of others, as the world continues to change, following the actions of this person, following the unraveling consequences of past actions, of those who don't even live anymore, promises bring certainty and stability into the world. Promises come before actions, so that we may come together and act in common. After actions, given the unpredictability and the fragility of human affairs and actions, given that usually what we try to do ends up leading to consequences that we might not even have wanted to have created, there remains the possibility of forgiveness. Not forgiveness so that we make wipe the slate clean and live happily ever after, but forgiveness so we may continue on and act anew given the consequences of past actions. So given this description of promises, it's not sufficient either to say, as you might if we follow the widespread tendency to quote Austin quickly, that a promise is a speech act. Austin studied how, in certain contexts, to say something is actually to act. He studied how to say something is to make it so. I can give a few examples. Justice of the Peace pronounces two persons married, and they are married. The Queen knights the dame by saying, I love thee, Dame Rebecca. And Rebecca is dame, knighted. The country enters war when the Prime Minister declares war on another country. Or now, war on a phenomenon such as drugs or terrorism. The air quotes won't translate, air quotes. Spoken in certain contexts by certain persons, words have a force largely because of conventions. So John Searle, who was one of Austin's students, provides us with an interesting comparison. He says that utterance acts stand to propositional and illocutionary acts in the way, for instance, in which making an X on a ballot paper stands to voting. So basically the condition of speech act is that the act wouldn't take place if the words hadn't been spoken. The act of voting is the act of making an X on a piece of paper in a site designed by Elections Canada. If I made an X on this piece of paper now and threw it in the direction, I wouldn't be voting for anyone. It's not called voting. It's a meaningless act, a very strange act. For us to stand up at this moment by saying, you will not stand up, I did not make you stand up. I don't have the capacity to cause that act. So, I'm saying that it will be insufficient to call a promise a speech act, because many promises have never been uttered, never been spoken. Many promises are implicit. They are part of the relationships we have with each other. A father doesn't have to promise his daughter to care for her, to protect her, to help her become a good and happy person, to encourage her, to respect her. Even if he provides for her without caring for her, she can rightly feel that he has let her down. She can rightly feel that she cannot trust him. Not because she has the right to be cared for, but because there's a kind of negligence that's criminal. Oh, those are all true. But because children expect certain actions on the part of their parents. These expectations, these promises come along with the roles we undertake. Same goes for promises of friendship. A friend of whom we cease to expect company, comfort, joy, respect, and encouragement simply because of an acquaintance from whom we sort of learn to guard ourselves, from whom we've learned to not expect too much. Though a promise is really made explicitly, pacts made in blood are very dramatic, but also very rare. And not just because of our fear of pain or diseases, but because our friendship with others is already in itself a promise of fidelity, faithfulness. Is there indeed a promise that doesn't have to do with fidelity, with faithfulness, with trust? So the promises that a parent makes to a child predate the relationship with the child. They underlie this relationship. They are its foundation. It's not there by virtue of nature or biology. It doesn't cease with death. And children are going to love and hate their parents based on their promises. Friends make a promise gradually. And their promise grows as their relationship does. They owe little to each other at first, and unless they go their separate ways, unless they cease to be friends because of geographical distance, because their character has changed, or because promises made to other friends make it impossible to keep other promises to other friends, they eventually owe each other everything. It would be insufficient to say as well that our promises define us. I'd rather say that we define ourselves through the promises we make and through the manner in which we keep or break them. So even implicit promises are our own actions. They underlie our actions, that are part of them, they give them their meaning. Promises are greater than the expectations others have of us. Perhaps for that reason, children will allow the parents to make new promises even as they break them. It's part of the deal. Parents are going to break some promises and children will look past it. Perhaps the strongest description of a promise through which I define myself as the person who promises, is the promise I can make to a friend on his deathbed. I can promise my friend that I'll tell his children who he is, who he was, who he will have been. I can promise him that I will keep his memory alive. Now I can no longer promise him anything. He can no longer judge me. It's up to me to decide whether the promise holds, whether I'll be happy with myself if I drift away from the memory of this relationship and the fidelity that underlaid it. I no longer owe him anything, even with everything he might have left me. Let me give you another example that might resonate a bit better with the setting in which I'm talking today. As a professor, I have many obligations to which sanctions are attached. There are a few things I could do that would make me lose my job, a few more that might lead some people to not rehire me in the future. But beyond these obligations, by standing in front of a classroom, by wielding a red fan a few times over the semester, I also make a number of promises. The promise to be fair and to leave my opinions aside, both my political and moral opinions, and my opinions of students' personalities. I made the promise to engage students on an equal footing, to bring them to think critically rather than to think like me, so that they may better face the personal, professional, and social problems they will encounter in the future. The promise to share my knowledge, to help students make it their own, through a process of critical integration, to accept and encourage students to put it to the test, so that this knowledge may grow and find ever new uses. If students and members of our society did not have these expectations of me and the professors in general, the university would not have its current stature and importance. It would simply be a diploma-granting institution. If I didn't respect these promises, I might continue to teach all the same, but I would lose the respect of my students. I would lose their trust. I would maintain with them a relationship of authority, but not the relationship that makes knowledge, equality, and freedom possible. Now, a promise in politics, a political promise, is a specific category of promise. Unlike the promise of the parent to the child, it is not unconditional. Unlike the promise of a friend, it is not mutual. When I speak of a democratic promise, I speak only of political promises. Democracy being radically different from friendship and family, and from the promises that lovers made to each other, promises of which I haven't spoken, which would require your own treatment. The promises that accompany love, be it filial love, friendship, or desire, are made by one person to another on a one-on-one basis. What's more, they are made to a specific person because of who the two persons are. Political promises are distinct from these promises that have to do with love, insofar as they are made to indefinite persons. The person who promises does not know the persons to whom she is making promises, although they know her and they judge her. So we can't speak in politics of a promise made to others because of who they are specifically. What makes such promises political is a certain kind of relationship that exists prior to the promise that situates us in this society and in the world. Today we participate in many forms of political relationships of representation, relationships of debate and dialogue, be they mediated by television or books, relationships of common ideology, relationships of projects, of work, of participation in common endeavors, relationships of party, the party, political party relationship, not fun party relationships, but also relationships of domination, of oppression, of exploitation, of exclusion, violent relationships that stifle us, but nonetheless define us. And often, many of these creative and violent relationships are present between any two persons. So we're always already engaged in social relationships in the same manner as we are always already engaged in familial relationships with our siblings and our parents. We affect each other, we have certain traits in common, because of who came before us, because of the habits and language we share, because of our proximity, because of the institutions in which we take part. But we are also always already engaged in political relationships through which others define who we are and what's possible for us to do. These political relationships decide, for instance, on whether we can make political promises to others, whether these promises to act can ever even be the undertaking of actions of consequence, even though the promises of revolt and struggle always remain possible. Democracy has made it possible, at least in principle, for everyone to make political promises and to act together, rather than to simply suffer from relations of violent power. Democracy has required those who rule to make promises not only to each other in the alliances that make up the politics of the elites and of international relations even today, but also to the people as a whole. Elections and their recurrent nature are the context in which the majority of the political promises are currently made. So in the light of the fragility and unpredictability of politics, we engage some candidates to govern and to respect their promises. We transform their words into effective promises. Those candidates who are not elected are released from the promises they made. The elected members of parties that are not in power are released from any expectation beyond those of a member of parliament. Perhaps they shouldn't be released. Perhaps a genuine parliamentary opposition requires that promises be made in case a party becomes part of the opposition. Yet this view of opposition in politics in which opposition is an intrinsic part of government, differs greatly from our current understanding of politics, where the winners take all, be it in the majority government, in the first-past-the-post system, or a coalition government, in the proportional representative system. Such premises would bind a candidate no matter if they win or lose, no matter if their party is in power or not, no matter if they go to the legislative assembly or back to their career. They would at once illustrate and strengthen a different vision of political life, where politics or its possibility accompanies our everyday life, insofar as our actions and even our intentions are shaped by politics. They would remind us that some persons act rather than be acted upon, and that anyone else can also act politically. To make such promises, to make such unconditional promises, would be to affirm ourselves as political beings. It would be to claim the right to shape our own life in the society in which we live, and which defines what's possible and what is not possible for us. The Bloc Québécois, in this respect, can serve as a limited example. Limited because governing is not its goal. Limited because it only makes promises of opposition and not promises of government. Limited because its promises of working towards Quebec sovereignty and defending Quebec's interests in Ottawa are ill-defined and can serve any agenda. Yet the Blociste member of Parliament state that they continue to represent the interests of the Quebecois nation, regardless of the riding where they were elected. They claim to represent every Quebecer as a member of that nation, regardless of the riding in which they live. Even beyond Parliament, sovereignists, be they elected or not, maintain the constant political obligation, uphold the constant political promise to their nation, to sing, to write about the nation and the country to come, to celebrate them, to talk about them to as many others as possible, so as to convince them that it's the only acceptable future, to pave the way for their possibility. A similar approach to politics can be found in communism, given that the communist acts towards the revolution and in the name of the exploited and the oppressed, as a member of the Communist Party, which is not a parliamentary party, but rather those who take the party, those who side with the working class. It's interesting to note in passing that Gilles Duceppe, the leader of the Bloc and its first elected member of parliament, was introduced into politics through Maoism, in case you didn't know. Now, both the Québécois sovereignists and the communists represent limited examples of a political promise. It's a promise that is carried on whether or not they are elected. But it's limited because the promise is made only to some persons, often against other persons, insofar as they belong to different and opposed social groups. Sovereignists make promises to Quebecers and no one else. The communists make promises to the working class and no one else. The promises they make, especially the promises that communists make, are made against the other groups in society. So this kind of a unilateral promise depends, on the one hand, on its extension to specific people at the exclusion of others, and on the other hand, depends on an engagement that vows itself to be independent of the outcome of the elections, negating the very importance and necessity of elections. So speaking of a democratic promise, I have something else in mind than these limited promises. When candidates make promises in an election, they hope to be elected, and they know that if they are, they'll be expected to a certain point to hold these promises. If they break their promises, they can expect to be voted out of office, to be replaced, and perhaps even to be demonized. There's a moral component to promises insofar as those who break promises are generally seen as morally bad, morally evil, unless they can justify their actions by an appeal to the greater good. In choosing our rulers, we like to select those who seem to be the most honest, the most virtuous, those who are good. But morality is not the essence of a political promise. It enters the equation here because of the proximity between political forms of promises and personal forms of promises, such as those I first talked about today. In making the promises, candidates give credence to the notion of the power of the people, be it the very limited power of choosing their rulers, as some political thinkers like to characterize democracy. The people will not only decide on their political future and on their capacity to accomplish their goals, but also on the moral character of candidates. The people define who politicians are, and in making promises to them, to the people, politicians recognize the power of the people. Politicians consent to present themselves at another election within a fixed period, or to leave politics. And in so doing, they consent to one of the minimal principles of democracy, that the people decide who rules. They agree to act democratically, and to behave in a democratic manner, so that the people may trust them. So while promises have to do with expenses, budgets, taxation, policy, relations with social groups, and foreign nations, while all these promises may be broken, what ensures the tie between the rulers and the ruled in a democratic country is this continued democratic promise, this implicit promise to act democratically. Yet politicians also fall short of this promise. They do so continuously, and their failure can only contribute to the creation of mistrust, of apathy, of disillusionment with all politicians, because they lower the expectations that people can have of them. Broken promises are not the sole source of political apathy, far from it, but this is a conversation we can have at a moment. Yet, what matters here is the second level of promises made by politicians, this democratic promise. I mentioned briefly, much earlier, that politicians are expected to break the promises, and just now that when they break the promises, they face another set of expectations. Let me describe some of these expectations so that we may understand more fully what the democratic promise is. We expect that politicians will explain their choices and their actions, as well as the possibilities that lay before them, even if they only do so collectively through the play of oppositions. We expect that they'll talk to us enough to say clearly something of substance as part of a continuous debate over what ought to be done. What's more, when politicians make choices that are difficult for us to live with, and when they break the promises, when they put lives in danger, when they make the inevitable choice to prioritize a certain course of action over another, we expect that they will justify these actions. That's what allows the trust to continue if they explain their choices and justify these tough choices. They must give us their reasons, lay out their reasoning, argue and defend themselves. When politicians explain and justify their actions, they allow us to take them on as our own actions or to reject them. They also do so pragmatically, rather than from the moral high ground of those who do not have to act, those who, because they are not in power, have clean hands. To take on an action or to reject an action is to allow ourselves to participate in them. It's not sufficient then to act, then for politicians to act in our name. For an action to be democratic, it must be accomplished in common. There must be at some point the possibility to accept it or refuse it. We also expect respect from politicians in a democracy. Respect for us, even if we agree with them, because we may have different reasons to agree. So they shouldn't discount us just because we happen to be members of the same party. But more importantly, we expect respect of others, respect of opposition. We expect from politicians who call themselves Democrats the respect of difference, both in choices and preferences, and in opinions as to what is to be done. Such respect requires inclusion and debate, and is related to the possibility that politicians might just be wrong, and that others might be right. That when more perspectives are considered, there might be a greater chance that we'll find a better course of action and actually succeed in this action. Action, after all, does not seek truth, it seeks success. Action can only succeed in two ways, but a kind of victory that deceives, that overpowers, that excludes, that eliminates opposition in the spirit of war, or by becoming not only agreement and not only a contract, but a common participation. So explanation, justification, communality of action, and respect of difference all suppose the recognition of our equality. Equality of speech, equality of in ruling our own life, in the horizon of our eventual equality in ruling ourselves and each other. What the Greeks, or the ancient Greeks called isigori, isonomi, and isokrasi. It's the recognition that no one, not even those who rule currently, not even those with the most expertise in diplomas, have a greater expectations to speak and to be heard. That no one has a greater expectations to alter the laws that regulate social interactions and relationships. That no one has a greater expectation to decide on their own life, you know, on the lives of members of their society. The recognition that no one has a title to govern, that no one lacks a title to govern. So at the basis of these recognitions lie two essential and interrelated recognitions. First, recognition of the communality of our lives, that we live together, and second, that of our responsibility towards others, insofar as our actions affect them, insofar as we owe our possibilities for creativity, success, and happiness to the structures of our common life. Without this communality, political policies would be impossible. It's because we are always already in a relationship with others that we can strengthen these relationships by binding ourselves to them. I don't mean that we bind ourselves in the legal sense or that we become obligated in the moral sense. Rather, I mean that in making a political promise, we accept our responsibility for the consequences of our actions on others, and we try to limit these consequences by undertaking an action with them. What makes it possible for us to make political promises is that although others remain indefinite in politics, although they remain unspecified, although we do not know each other, we affect each other through the consequences of our actions. And we do this without being able to predict what these consequences will be or who they will reach. So the more public power someone is given, the more people they will reach with the consequences of their actions. Political responsibility then lies in finding out as much as possible as to what these consequences may be. It lies in choosing with the knowledge that we cannot fully predict and know these consequences. The knowledge that something will inevitably escape us. This responsibility includes the responsibility of knowing the consequences of apoliticism, the consequences of our refusal to participate in politics, both for ourselves and for others. It includes the responsibility to recognize that we affect others no matter we act by ourselves, or whether we act by letting others act in our place. The recognition that everything we do or not do affects others in the structures of social life. So the democratic promise is the assumption of this responsibility. So these expectations, which come from the democratic promise made by politicians, should be seen as part of the minimal aspects of democracy, even though they are not respected at the moment. In other words, what I'm saying is that if these expectations indeed constitute part of democracy, if democracy is impossible without these expectations, then we don't live in a democracy. The democratic promise is usually implicit, although it's also sometimes explicit. It's explicit when the rule of law is sought. It's explicit when corruption is targeted. It's explicit when democratic values are being devalued. Whether implicit or explicit, when this promise is broken, when this promise is used solely strategically, only the rulers rule, only the rulers have power, and we have anti-democratic actions, even if these actions are undertaken in the name of the people, even if they benefit the people. So the promise that's inherent in democracy, what is yet to come and can be expected when politicians promise to act democratically, is that politics is becoming our affair, those who are in positions of power recognize that this power comes, that their power comes from the assent, the consent, or the participation of the people, and the promise to share this power with the people. We didn't have a gap, a distance between liberal democracy as a system of government and what John Dewey called the idea of democracy, what I'm calling the promise of democracy. With politics becoming our affair through democracy, a process that's been happening for a few centuries now, we begin to recognize that our lives are already political and that we need not accept to have our lives and our relationships shaped by others. We can enter into political relationships, we can make promises to each other and to everyone else, we can shape our own lives together rather than leaving others to do it in our place. So in my book I argue that political apathy is not the result of a lack of interest in politics or of a lack of knowledge about politics, rather that it stems from the impossibility to know and to act. It stems from the lack of the means necessary to act. In other words, that political apathy is the result of powerlessness. When politicians make us the promise that they will act democratically, they make our power, the power of the people, possible. When they break this promise, they turn us away from politics by making politics appear as their domain, as exclusively theirs, because of their characteristics, because of their competences, because of their contacts, because of their degrees. They turn us away from politics by making elections solely about choosing who will lead us. They turn us away from politics by limiting our involvement to elections. Politicians can break the promises, their electoral promises, as long as they maintain their democratic promise. When they hold this promise, they allow us to act with them. They make us want to act on our own and with others, and not just against others in the murderous rage of riots. It's not only politicians who must make this promise. And speaking of the power of the people, I'm not speaking only of governmental power. I'm also speaking of economic power. Power in the workplace, power in the process of production, of distribution, and of consumption of goods and services. Earlier I gave the example of the promises I make as a professor. And indeed, intellectual power must also be shared and can be shared the most easily. It's not enough for me to tell you that you must participate in politics, that you shouldn't be apathetic. I must also share my knowledge with you. And as John Dewey suggested, knowledge is nothing unless and until it is shared. To share knowledge, to share understanding, is to test them. If they cannot be shared, then nothing but opinion and faith. Finally, one of the conditions of the self-rule of anyone, the self-rule of everyone, is that as many perspectives as possible are shared and taken into account by those who are about to act, so that when they act, as many possibilities as possible are considered, so that as many consequences and outcomes as possible are considered, so that what is probable and improbable is known and used as the basis for action. In this manner, people, as many people participate as possible, in this manner, as many people as possible can act and participate rather than simply being acted upon. The promise of democracy is already present when politicians make the promises at election time. The promise to take a certain course of action if they are elected, because it is made alongside other promises, because it is made contingently on being elected, relies on the power given by the people to undertake this course of action in the first place. In turn, the power of the people is what makes possible the power of any individual politician. By presenting themselves in a democratic election, by accepting to hold such elections in the future, politicians also make the democratic promise to act so as to include rather than to exclude others. And this form of democracy promises that fuller promises be made by anyone and everyone, promises that engage and bind us regardless of circumstances, outside of the logic of gains and losses, so that we may continue to act together, so that we may all participate in shaping our own and each other's lives.
Thing.
I've put forward quite a few ideas. I'm very, very happy to clarify any of them. I would hope that you jump at my throat and try and take this apart so we may engage in a good exchange here.
On an applied level, what did we have in Alberta? Was it 40% or whatever voter turnout last time?
Something around there, yeah.
I don't know, federally. So how do you read our situation in terms of your analysis? If you say political apathy is due to powerlessness, and then what would change that?
That's a very big question. I'm supposed to lay down, a 5-year plan for democratizing Alberta.
Are you happy with it? No.
I think it's the thing we can see in Albertan politics, especially with what's basically single party rule over the past few decades, is that if you want to have any kind of effect, any kind of power over shaping your own life and over shaping the lives of your the other members of society in Alberta, you have to become a member of the ruling party. And so we have people who might become members of the Liberal or the New Democratic parties joining the Progressive Conservative Party so as to be able to at least pull the party to one side. And in the end, voting in favor of positions that are completely opposed to their own. If that's the best way to gain any kind of political influence, to gain political power in the province, it shouldn't be surprising that people have the feeling that they can't influence politics. That politics belongs to those who are established within the Progressive Conservative Party. That politics belongs to those who, maybe now, those few who are willing to stand up against them and create a brand new party. We'll see what comes out of that. But even in this case, such as when the Progressive Conservative Party came into power, the matter that's being discussed between the Wilders Alliance and the Progressive Conservatives is not one of policy, but one of change, for the sake of change. No arguments are being made. Nobody gives the reasons. Politics take place in a whole different sphere that barely seems to affect us. So how do we change that? Maybe those who disagree with the Progressive Conservative should not join the Progressive Conservative Party. Maybe. I think most importantly, what I would argue is that politicians, just as intellectuals, have a responsibility to engage others, to try and reach out to them. Not simply to show up and yell at them, as certain premiers have done in the past. But that's as far as I'll go, as far as Alberta politics go, because I'm nearly a neophyte in Alberta politics. I've been here only a few years.
I work for Elections Canada, actually. My job when the writ is issued is to convince young voters to vote. I'm so excited that they're going to pay me to do this. So my question to you, you're preaching to the choir in this room because we were all willing to come and hear this, and I think most of us agree with you in some way. But in your teaching career or as a person, what have been your experiences in talking about this from a philosophical perspective with people who don't agree with you? What have been the joys and challenges of that?
I could take the easy way out and say I'm relatively young, so I don't have much experience in doing this. I just defended my thesis 2 years ago. I'm just trying this out now. So the book I wrote is not an academic book. The point is to actually have it be sold at a cheap enough price that people might actually consider buying it, as opposed to selling it for $120 only that libraries buy the hardcover version. The point of writing something like this is that hopefully it'll appeal to a position of politics that everybody shares. Beyond that, I don't have a holdout report. Maybe once there's reactions to this, maybe I can ask for reactions here in this room. I've been in a good position to respond. I might say, though, that when people talk to me about politics in a way that engages what I feel matters, when people talk about political problems, so as to frame it, not in matters of the intricacies of, you know, backroom politics, not in the intricacies of what happens in Parliament Hill between question period and afternoon affairs, but as something that we do together. When people talk about politics as a common enterprise, as opposed to the enterprise of a few people who have been chosen by the people as these leaders because they are almost superhuman, I suddenly tend to find it a lot easier to get involved. I suddenly find it easier to not be so cynical about politics. So, in a sense, I'm trying to get you to start claiming politics as something that's part of your life, that belongs to you, not just to other people who have enough time on their hands or enough support behind them to make a job out of it. I'm probably right beside your question here, so you can redirect if you like.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate what you're saying, and that is an important aspect of my job, is to give people that ownership of, you know, this is something that you can, and this is something you participate in, whether you mean to or not, so let's do that. So that is very helpful, and that works well.
Something that's important too, when you talk about working for Elections Canada, that's great. But we already understand that elections are political. There are huge aspects of our lives that are also political that we don't really deal with, that we leave to others. We're happy to delegate our responsibility in the workplace to our superiors. Oftentimes we don't have a choice because we might get fired otherwise. But that still happens. So a disengagement in politics is, I think, tied to a general perception or sense of powerlessness. So that we should see more than just elections as being part of political life. If you have any suggestions to how you can get that across to more people than just people in this room, more people than those that have to coerce into showing up because you know, at the same time you're expected to be here, then please let me know.
Something you said about promises and how it can connect to morality, where politicians are, I was just thinking about all the politicians we hear about scandals of, various in their personal lives, and they've broken promises, they've had an affair or whatever it is, so they've broken promises in one way, and I kind of wondered, well, what's the fascination with that, but this connection to, if they're breaking promises here, this is, they're breaking promises, it sort of calls into question these other, their ability to maintain promises. I don't know, it's just something interesting.
I agree. I think it's something we definitely tend to do as soon as a politician breaks a promise, we perceive they've broken the promise in their personal lives, or even in the life of the party, we talk about corruption, not even misappropriation of public funds, but things that are more limited than that. We tend to translate that into the political realm. And my argument is that maybe we shouldn't. Mm-hmm. We'd like to have these great, morally exceptional persons in power, but maybe there's a problem with expecting moral qualities when politics demand that promises be broken, demand at times, or it is argued anyway, that other people be used as means towards public safety and be used as kind fodder. Those questions come up, and we don't think that politicians are evil for starting a war. Well, most of them, anyway. And when that happens, usually we have other issues with them in the first place, right? So there's that bridge between morality and politics that's always problematic, that we just tend to do because discussions of judgment, because we see politicians as individuals, that we tend to flag people morals on them. which is not to say that politicians should be excused of whatever they're doing, but I believe that their personal wrongdoings, their personal relationships should matter a lot less than whether or not they uphold their promise to act democratically.
But I wonder if one of the reasons that happens is because those democratic promises are more invisible. Like, you don't see them. So when they break those, it's harder to... You know what I'm saying? Like, some people might say they're implicit. They're not... They're to an indefinite group of people. They're not as... It's harder to get a handle on.
And that's
sometimes.
That's why we need opposition.
We need to make it visible.
That's why we need people like columnists, editorialists,
right.
Journalists,
right.
People like intellectuals who will actually speak up and call...
Yeah.
Those who govern come about and say that they are breaking their promise.
Mm-hmm.
James Travers at the Toronto Star has been calling Stephen Harper authoritarian ever since the first prorogation took place. So he said, stolen my thunder. But at the same time, I can't help but agree that there's something there that is authoritarian. He's not the only one to have done that. To have undertaken authoritarian actions. And if he justified it, it would be a lot different. But that's why we need a position, not just in Parliament, but outside of Parliament, to actually call up with the politicians on what they're doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I find it horribly interesting. I'm 22, so if I'm talking 5 years about anything politics, you know, like probably 90% of them don't agree with anything that's going on, right? And we can start off a conversation and you can go, Clinton, who likes him? And then everybody laughs. And then, because his personal life is in shambles or was. And then you say, well, what about Bush? Oh, he's just as bad, you know? And then you can ask them, well, what did Clinton accomplish? And then nobody knows anything about it. What did Bush accomplish? Oh, that was terrible. Then isn't Clinton okay? And then nobody can really answer that question because nobody looks at it. And then nobody can tell you anything because it's not like that. But especially for the younger generation, as I find we should be looking at, and that interests people, the whole idea of promises and morality. So if that's going to get the word out to younger generations, I think it's a good thing to explore.
The idea is that what that conveys is that politics is about relationships with other people. That we are in this weird, extremely mediated relationship with those who are in power, but we are still in a relationship with them, and they hurt us. They make us cry when they break the promises. They shouldn't do it. And as far as Clinton goes, I think it goes again to the mix-up between morality and politics. We'll remember Clinton for the Lewinsky affair, and not for what happened in Bosnia. The fact that he paved the way for the George Bush's intervention in Iraq by the bombings.
But that's the thing, that when you talk about it, Clinton is just as bad as Bush, and isn't Bush the worst thing somewhere else? You know, like, how can you compare those two people at all? It's scary to think people.
So,
I think the big issue here, the million-dollar question, is how is faith restored once it's been lost? If we can't get people to vote if they don't trust the people they're voting.
Okay.
And several of my coworkers, they don't want to vote at all because they don't trust anybody across the board because they think they're unethical or, you know, they've got poor judgment or whatnot. You know, they can't stand behind their platforms.
And that goes to what I was saying, that when one politician breaks the promises, they're doing this favor to all politicians. But I have one name for you. Obama. Look at Bush's second electoral campaign. People didn't care. They didn't care about the Democratic primaries. They didn't care about John Kerry. Nobody managed to restore the faith or the trust in politicians, and so nothing really changed. Obama comes along, and suddenly people who have never voted for a very long time or ever go to vote in very, very large numbers. I think Obama would be a good example of someone who upholds democratic promises and, you know, has to break some of them because recessions happen. And then, well, can do what you want to do if you don't have any money, if you have to worry about the whole country, the whole country is going to be going down the drain. But Obama speaks to people, even now, even as president. His speeches actually have reasoned arguments. We can find reasons to disagree or agree with him. We don't have to rely on personal moral judgment. Because maybe we'll act morality because we have nothing else to go on. But one reason for why for doing what he's done, reasons for doing what he's going to do are given, we can really evaluate whether or not we can get on board with him. And if we disagree, then at least we disagree through a certain exchange with him. We're not simply excluded from politics altogether. Maybe.
Well, with Michael and Nancy have been there in the last couple of years, it's almost felt like promises from the Conservatives don't mean crap because they seem to have gotten hold of power. They hold on to that, and whatever they do is their choice. We don't even have a choice. They don't have to make promises, basically. So I like the fact that you reiterated that opposition is so necessary, and hopefully that this year, leading up to these elections that supposedly are coming, that we can get some good opposition there.
And we need the opposition to make promises too.
Yes.
Just what will they do if they're in power? I mean, nobody wants to travel without being in power. That's the issue. Campaign Jack Layton started by saying, I'm going to be Prime Minister and I'm planning for a job as Prime Minister. Well, yeah, but we're not that silly, really.
Well, even with the Gaggett, no one knew what he was going to do. There were no promises being made, so nobody really understood what was going on. So I guess the promises need to be there in order for us to grasp on to the politics of it all.
Yeah, I think teasing out the difference between interpersonal morality and, if you want to call it, political morality, I think is important. And I think that's the reaction here from the south of the border. And maybe it had a bit of currency in Canada, but never as strongly, that because people are cynical about politicians, then you vote for somebody who appears to be either the godly person or the moral person, but measured on interpersonal level. So then you shift away from the what is your democratic promise, and not just the implicit one, but what are you promising is that you're going to work towards, to say, no, we'll trust this person because that person is morally good in the interpersonal or religious sense or whatever, right? So I think it's that confusion that, you know, Bush got voted in twice, you know, so even after, if you want all the political stuff, you know, we will not be involved in nation building. We will not be involved, whatever, in the first round, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, we're having them all over, you know, as the policemen of the world. So, but people don't bring that together, and you simply then trust. You want to trust somebody, and so you have leaders that you trust. Canada hasn't quite got that same culture, you know, but I think there are tendencies of that. So you try to find, well, then who's the morally good person rather than what are the policies this person is going to represent and are they effective in representing them, you know, or inviting others to speak.
And you can even transfer the whole discussion to the impression that we have of our leaders. Are they leaders or merely politicians, merely men and women who are going to try and do things with us? If you look at the change in the NDP's message over the last few years, it's been Jack Layton's NDP. Mm-hmm. When you go on the NDP's website, what you find is leadership in huge mm-hmm. letters. Well, that's great, but what made the NDP different when it became the NDP in the CCF was that it was based on all these social movements. It was this huge attempt by large numbers of people to come together and act together. And to not have that overwhelming, superseding leadership that other partners tend to have.
So welcome to Ralph's world and welcome to Jack's world.
But we look for leaders, strong people, so that makes it harder for women who are generally seen in the public imagination as caring, right? And good persons, but you know, the gender stereotypes matter here. Yeah, we're looking for strong leaders. Parties will find specific types of people. This is, again, looking for personal characteristics rather than actions. To go back to what Arendt also says, she talks about politics being a matter of who we are, not what we are. So who we are has to do with the actions we've led, we've undertaken, what we've done, what we've promised, how we have acted in the past. And we see still a level of what we are, you know, our origins, our nationality, our gender, even our personal actions. We're talking about a whole different part of our existence. And what we do in one sphere doesn't necessarily translate into the other. Politics, for her, is the attempt to extricate ourselves from what we are, to become someone, to fashion ourselves by through our actions. And when we don't act, we let others define us. So we want strong leaders, people with characteristics, looking for a what, not looking for a who, for what it can do for us, for what it can do with us. And we are remaining something rather than someone, so far as we are being shaped and we're not active. She says, we're still responsible even when we're not doing anything. Does letting things happen, being a vessel for other people's actions, is still participating in these actions. No one has clean hands, is the idea here. Need of attention. I'm happy to entertain other questions or comments or clarifications.
I have more, but more than I have others.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, how do you hold people accountable for their promises, especially in places where class, for example, plays a role, their race plays a role? How do you hold them accountable then?
It's possibly the most burning problem we're facing as far as democracy goes. Democracy has only gone so far as we've been able to hold politicians accountable. And let's not kid ourselves, gender, race, and ethnicity, and class have been very important in deciding who gets to have influence, who gets to feel that they can influence politics, who can feel that politics is part of their lives, and who doesn't, who feels that they have no chance of acting in politics. My suggestion is that intellectual power is the easiest way, the easiest kind of power to transmit. Because intellectual power depends on being shared. So in the workplace, you have very strong structures in the economy. As far as classes concerned, you have very, very strong divisions, very strong barriers towards change. In politics, we have strong barriers as well, as far as who participates. And so there's a responsibility of those who make a living out of trying to find out what is true or what makes sense and what doesn't, to involve as many others as possible. And this costs us nothing. A bit of time. But this costs me nothing. I get to put it on the CV, but I get to call on to others to call on to their politicians. And beyond that, the real challenge for democracy is to put in place institutions that will force politicians to include more people. So the Charter of Human Rights is a great thing. Using the Charter of Courts, I think, in this regard, is a great way to force politicians to act in a certain way. It's not enough, but it's at least a start. At least it's there now. We can't depend on the goodwill of politicians for change to happen. Because sometimes they have to break their promises, sometimes they feel that they have to break their promises. But that's absolutely probably the most important question that's been raised today. How do we actually do this? Okay, if trust is broken, we won't vote for them again. What's the alternative?
I I'm wondering, sort of, in countries like Canada, for example, where so much of the economy is based on international mining, or in countries which are indebted to the World Bank, when economy is such a burden on the political process, and that influence of industry or of this and that, where does that fit with the promises, and what challenge and what calling do we have there?
I think a first consideration we need to make is that we can actually only do so much. We have to know what's possible at this point. Change is going to be only incremental. So we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that we're going to suddenly change how the whole economy works. Because even if we had the perfect approval of everyone in the country, this, you know, 35, 32 million people in on a 7 billion people's planet, with the global market. I think this vision of politics tends to lean toward the idea of a certain amount of intervention into the economy, but also a certain amount of participation in the economy. And we can't grant ourselves what we will not grant others. I mean, that's the basic idea of responsibility. Those who have power, be it economic or political, have no right to keep this power for themselves, because it depends on others. Well, the same goes when we talk about our rights and the rights of those who work for companies overseas. Once again, the question becomes, how do we actually put that into action? Give me 10 years and I might have a half an answer for you. as far as I'm coming from.
But maybe the point is that, and it's maybe more visible, I mean, obviously visible, let's say, because of like Brazil or whatever, that when people get voted into office, the power they have is still very limited. Because, as you're saying, there's all the international, if you want, economic structures that are in place. So when Lula got voted in for, you know, putting a different stamp on Brazil, it was, in a certain way, an unrealistic promise. It would be different, but he still had to negotiate with the World Bank. He still had to take loans from the IMF, you know, all this kind of stuff. And that had all sorts of conditions, and therefore then his, you know, so people were afraid. I mean, banks actually had pulled money out of, before the election, out of Brazil, because if he wouldn't really go in a socialist direction, they didn't want to invest. He couldn't afford to lose the money out of the country. You know, so you're forced to promise something which, in a certain sense, you can't keep because of some of these economic realities that that Tiff is referring to. So then, how do you negotiate within that? It still has some credibility. I mean, it's still in power.
Bringing change to the world order, or in the world order, is definitely a challenge. It's definitely. I mentioned this in passing. I think at times it is important to make promises that we can't keep, because it's. People will know that maybe this politician will try. Or at least this is the direction that this politician would rather go in. So if they're faced with a dilemma or a question, this is the direction they'll be going into. There's so much that's unpredictable in politics that we have to allow for this kind of guesswork. So in this way, some people might have thought that Lula was going to bring these reforms in. Some people might not have believed him and still voted for him. But again, we have to be aware that there is a balance of power in the world, politically, militarily, and economically, and that there are people in the world, not just individuals, but citizens of specific countries that have a much larger pool than others. And I'm not just talking about the U.S. here. I think at this point, if Obama was to realize everything he promised and more, we'd still be left with a lot of the same problems we have right now because of how the other super economies are behaving in the world. That's the question that every political theorist who deals with, you know, personal politics is afraid of, because in the end, we still have to deal with international relations. We still have to deal with that massive chaos that's barely organized, that many want to keep unorganized.
It makes me wonder then, what does democracy mean? Because on paper, it's the rule by the people.
Right.
But it seems now it becomes more louder, or it becomes more clearer when, for example, the government gets pressure from the international world. And it makes me wonder then, what democracy is that, if at all it exists?
I think one thing we've learned over the past few decades is that elections don't guarantee democracy.
Okay.
That's the first thing we have to realize, is that bringing elections somewhere doesn't necessarily create democracy. And in fact, there might be ways of having a democratic country without elections. Might be. I'm young. When I was 75, and this is, you know, brought against me, I'll say I was young, you know. But I think we have to entertain those kinds of ideas. Maybe elections are not the only way to get at democracy. Maybe they are central, but not enough. Yet most leaders and political thinkers continue to defend democracy in terms of elections. We know very well that elections are, you know, only span a certain amount of time and only allow the people to do so much. We have to see what else stands in the way of democracy. We have to look at military power. We have to look at economic power, the things that keep the vast majority of populations away from any kind of decision making. So what does democracy mean? Oh, I think it's the participation of people in the decisions that affect their own lives. That goes from day-to-day decisions about how we're going to do the job we do, to overarching decisions as to what kind of laws we want. How do we bring that about? Well, how do we bring about what we do have? Little by little, by forcing those who were willing to do something from the forces of change and encourage them. And twist their arm a little bit sometimes.
Well, I guess it's a matter of taking the individual and saying to oneself and getting that mindset out there to us all that our promise of democracy to ourselves does not end with an X on the ballot box.
Right. Absolutely. The promises are made before that and are meant to be kept or not after that. Yeah. That's merely a small part in the overall democratic process.
Now, I live in Canada, we don't really pay attention as much to political promises as they do maybe in the States. We normally vote on like emotions. Who's annoyed us the most, most frequently? Who caused the election?
Right.
And all that. So how do we vote on who, what leader looks the best? Or like what political beliefs we have already. There's very little room for people changing their opinions.
Right, I think we have the problem. I think the problem is present in the States too. This is one of the problems when issues or policy aren't at the heart of campaigns. We don't really get a feel for people's stand other than through their identification to a party. And our parties have such strongly defined positions that we know, for the most part, we know who we're going to vote for. Either because they represent continuity with other politicians we don't like, because we have nobody better, nobody that's more to the right and more to the left to vote for.
It's not really democracy, then it's just like a failed democracy. People just voting not on what's important,
but I really think that elections are never going to be enough to convince people to be interested in politics. It's thrilling. It's an event. If you look at what happens when you follow it, but very little is actually decided during the campaign.
I'm curious if you have any comments about what the impact might be of moving to proportional representation. The moment first past post, and we end up being ruled by people who take their power, and a large percentage of the people don't feel represented by them, feel, and I'm wondering if that's part of the source of the apathy and the cynicism that comes. I have no power. I cast my vote, but my guy didn't win. And now my voice is silent for another 4 years. And that's, I'm not arguing for, I'm just curious if you had views on that.
I just be very ambivalent about proportional representation. I've actually recently changed my views on this. I think as a matter of justice, as far as each person having a voice, proportional representation might be seen as more just. Now, if you are interested, I'll give you a reference to a good book about this in the Canadian context. At the same time, if my argument is that apathy has to do with a sense of powerlessness, having a multi-party system, having a proportional representation system, is not quite going to cut it either. One of the problems is that in a multi-party system, no party can uphold the promises. There's a lot more compromise. And in that sense, there's a lot more people acting together, so that's good on that side. But nobody actually does what they promised during the campaign, because it's impossible. You have to make a government with many people. So for a while, I was convinced that it was a good thing, and now I'm not sure that it's going to really change. So maybe it's one of the steps, but it's often presented as the solution for ending political apathy, and I really don't see that happening. Again, because the focus remains on elections and on our voice. But what happens to our voice for all these parties that have to work together after the elections, after they have to make their coalitions, after they have to come to agreements? Where do we figure in them? And I don't think that multi-party parliamentarism has a lot more to offer than the first past the post and the two-party system that we have.
But isn't that the point? I mean, when you've got a lot of difference, then automatically you have a lot of compromise.
Automatically you have a lot of what, sir?
Compromise,
yeah.
Yeah, so in other words, so if it is democratic, then it has to be a discussion. And there has to be an engagement.
Right.
So that means automatically there has to be compromises made just to come up with something that we can agree to.
I think that if parties in a multi-party system actually represented different areas of society and different political opinions and went back to the population and engaged the population, and then came together and make arrangements in the boardroom together, then maybe that would work. But the truth is that in multi-party systems, you still have the party elite that gets together, does the program, presents that to the people, drop the party lists, and send people to the cabinet depending on proportion and importance in the coalition, and then make decisions. Well, instead of having, 20 members of the Conservative Party, as we do right now, and that's being generous, we have, 7 members of the Conservative Party, 6 members of the Liberal Party, and 2 members of the NDP, or however you want to break it up, making decisions. A way without much relation to the rest of the population anyway. So I think our understanding of representative government is what we have to look at. I'm not saying that we need a direct participation, that we need direct democracy. I'm not saying that we have to give up representative democracy either, but that there has to be a way to engage the population outside of election campaigns. One of the ways to do that is to force politicians to actually explain what they're doing. But beyond that, as far as structural changes, I'm very uncertain as to how much can actually be achieved through a change in the voting or party system. One thing that proponents of proportional representation often forget is that while the countries with the highest participation in elections are usually countries with a proportional representation, there is a large number of countries with proportional representation that have as low a voter turnout as we do. So maybe that's not what the cause is.
So maybe then, picking up on what you said, I don't know your name, but where you're sort of talking about how many Canadians vote on, you know, the brand of liberal, you know, oh, that's such a liberal idea, so I agree with it, or what have you. Maybe we need to move away from compromise and into collaboration, because that might start to deconstruct the brands and the labels that we fall back on. And then if you have something like proportional representation or even a better functioning minority government, there's collaboration instead of just compromise, because then everybody slightly wins instead of slightly loses. Would you see a difference in that? Would that be a big shift?
I'd maybe put the shift somewhere else as far as collaboration goes. I think compromise is going to be important regardless. I think parties are going to be more to the left and to the right at some point. Once they actually start governing, they'll be pulled to the middle, and that's fine. But right now, if you look at the way the federal and provincial governments work, there's really two ways to make something happen. Either the Prime Minister wants something to take place, or the Premier, and it takes place. It's a matter of days, and it's happened. The Prime Minister can announce to his cabinet what the government is going to do in a press conference at the same time as the rest of the population, and it will happen. Agencies and departments are going to magically coordinate, get this hierarchy, this chain of command, it's all going to get done. The other way is the way that everything else gets done, the issues that aren't priorities for the Prime Minister. And this is where we have the most the biggest advances in democracy in this country, I think, over the past few decades. You have this huge process of consultation between departments, so between different parts of the bureaucracies, between different parties in parliamentary committees overseeing what the bureaucracy is doing, and between other representatives, the bureaucracy, and the population as a whole. We have not just experts, but representatives of stakeholders, even if we're using that language, right? Members of society who will be affected by this decision actually come in and talk and help the bureaucrats and the politicians make these decisions. But that takes a long time. There's a lot of money. It's hard work. Democracy is hard. This temptation to just get things done. And believe me, Harper, Martin, Chrétien, all the way to Trudeau, they knew how to make things happen. If you want to uphold progress, you have to make things happen. It's that simple. But if you want things to be democratic, you have to, you know, let others not just talk, but weigh in on the decision itself. You have to give up control. How do you make political promises? That's why I'm talking about the promise to act democratically as opposed to electoral promises that what's going to be done with taxes and budgets and all those kind of things. Because maybe, as far as the ministry is concerned, that's more important. Maybe at times we decide, okay, we need to overhaul the healthcare system, we need to overhaul the education system, we need to do something with our army, and then we'll get stuff done in a different manner. But if we're going to be a democratic country, if we're going to have democratic politicians, if they're going to call themselves Democrats, then they have to act in a certain manner that means giving up control. And they've been willing to do it on issues they don't care about. Issues that don't make or break elections.
I think one of the main problems with Canadian politics as a whole is that they're forced to vote on party lines, so there's really no... You're just voting for a party, you're not voting for the person who's running in your region to help the region specifically and vote for that. That's why it sort of failed democracy.
Well, that's the problem. It's a problem that might stay around if we have a multi-party democracy as well. there's been a few attempts at curbing the party line over the past few years, not that really amounted to very much. Again, if you want to get things done, you have to have people voting your way. The parties the parties and the government are structured in such a way as to make that possible. So, yeah, party line is a pretty good tool if you want to make sure that your law gets passed, that your name is on the bill at the end. But maybe the rest is about not having your name on the bill. Maybe we should just make sure that nobody can introduce a motion and have it be remembered that it was theirs. Have a collective amnesia for policy.
Well, that's already effective.
No, I was just going to say, okay, here everyone really talk, but I think this whole thing that we have all these problems is our mindset that's and we're just talking about. If I don't get elected, my representative doesn't get elected in, then I'm not represented. I'm left powerless. There, I don't belong in politics. I don't belong in this government. I'm going to wait 4 years. But that's not what you were saying today. The opposition is so important here. I am the opposition. I am not represented in power, but I am represented because I'm there to counterbalance what's in there. And if I don't take that role and just, you know, tuck my tail between my legs and wait 4 years and do nothing, because it's like saying I don't have power. Changing our mindset is a way to go. How to change it, I'm not sure.
What I'm trying to get at this point is that we don't necessarily have to change the way that the political system works. We don't necessarily have to change the political structures. I'm going to very literally quote Václav Havel, a Czech head of state who was a dissident under the communist Czechoslovak government, originally, who basically said that. Now that I said all this, I really forgot what I was going to say. A bit of importance on how much responsibility we each have all the time to maintain the overall backdrop, but that the real political change, there we have it, real political change isn't going to come from voting somebody else in. It's not going to even change by changing how we decide who gets voted in. And this is a man who's talking at a time in a place where you have one-party rule. So it's changing the basic political structures of the state isn't going to be enough. What we need is to change the way that society works. We need to change political culture. We need to change the way we relate to each other. We need to live in truth instead of living in a lie. We need to take on power as our own instead of letting others shape us. Because in the shape us, we're still using this power to, well, not use our power.
That might be just about time, but thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.